Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And so good to have you with me today. Man, what's happening? I'm up in Montana, and it's June 18th, and it snowed yesterday. Full-on snow. Woke up, the mountains are white. If you ever wanted to move to Montana, just be aware, snowstorms in June, snowstorms in late September, even early September, these are not that uncommon. So yeah, maybe temper your Yellowstone expectations, the TV show, with the fact that it's winter here, like 9 months of the year. Even still, beautiful. It's cool to be up here. And have a great interview today. Really enjoyed this one. My guest today, Justin Mares, he is the founder of Kettle and Fire, which is a company that makes high-end, very high-quality bone broth. He's the founder of Perfect Keto, a non-alcoholic wine company called Surly. He's a venture partner at Long Journey. He's also the co-founder and CEO at TrueMed. Owns a ton of companies, been in the e-commerce game a long time, and had a fantastic conversation. We dive in to a ton of stuff. We talk about retail. He has, top of my head, I think he's sold hundreds of millions of dollars. Companies have sold hundreds of millions of dollars into retail. So we talk about his lessons there from when retail is a good fit, when it isn't, his lessons about package design to help your product stand out, the ROI of retail, how it took him 5 or 6 years sometimes to break even, but why it's such a powerful moat once you do. We dive into America's food crisis, which is something he's passionate about and has really fueled his businesses. We even get into kind of some bikepacking adventures near the end and learning how to recharge and unplug. So it's a great conversation. He's a super smart guy, deeply enjoyed it, and hope you find it just as useful as I did. So we're going to go ahead and jump into that right after this. Today's episode is brought to you by the E-commerce Fuel private community for 7- and 8-figure owners. We have an amazing, vibrant forum where you can connect and get answers to your questions, but probably one of the biggest long-term values is our events, where you can build deep connections with other owners. We have ECF Live, our annual summit, where all of our members and attendees are vetted versus, you know, a lot of e-commerce events where you have zillions of people trying to sell you stuff. We have adventures, great talks, curated dinners. Ecom Camp, which is our annual event for 8-figure store owners and smaller meetups and dinners throughout the year. So if you're looking to connect with people just like you, people in e-commerce obsessed with their business who can talk about it for hours, our community is the place to do it. So if that sounds interesting, you can find out more information and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Attention Shopify sellers, say goodbye to annoying design limitations and outdated user interfaces. Now you can customize every inch of your website with the brand new landing page builder inside the Zipify Pages app. Zipify Pages just released their biggest upgrade ever, so now you can drag, drop, or swap any element on practically any page to make your store look and perform exactly the way you want it to. Zipify Pages was created by my friend Ezra Firestone, founder of a $175 million Shopify store, and it's packed with over 70 marketing templates you can use to generate leads, run promos, and scale any brand. And because the templates come from Ezra's own 8- and 9-figure brands, you know they actually work. You can try Zipify Pages and their brand new builder for free for 14 days at zipifypages.com. That's Z-I-P-I-F-Y pages.com. For TrueMed, is it a way that helps you take HSA funds and be able to easily spend them on, instead of like, obviously like aspirin or doctor business would qualify, but things that are less traditionally thought of as medical, but still have hugely beneficial medical and fitness properties?
Yeah. So basically like the whole thesis of the company is the IRS recognizes very few things as medicine. So they'll recognize things that like treat, alleviate, or prevent certain conditions. That made sense when HSA, FSA legislation was written in like the early 2000s. Like most of the country did not have a chronic disease. Today, like 85% of Americans are overweight or obese. Like almost 93% have at least one metabolic condition or are at risk of like some sort of chronic disease. And if you look at the studies, basically studies support the idea and the fact that like the most efficacious treatments are things that we would consider like root cause disease, like exercise, diet, supplementation, sleep aids, things like that. And so what we're doing is we're basically unlocking HSA, FSA funds for a category of like products and services that are not eligible for HSA, FSA spend unless it's accompanied by a doctor's note. And so we've built this like payment tool that like an Athletic Greens or Eat Sleep can install on their checkout that allows their customers who qualify to use HSA, FSA dollars when they check out to purchase like some of these different products. So we, you know, we've signed up like a couple hundred merchants at this point and are making it so that they can offer their customers HSA, FSA as like a way to save money as they're buying, you know, some of these more expensive like medical products.
Interesting. Fascinating. Actually, total little rabbit trail, but I got a little AG1 here I'm drinking.
Nice.
And give it, you know, this space so much better than I do. Supplementation from a health perspective. I think we can use AG. If people are listening and don't know AG1, I'm guessing most people do. It's been at top, probably top advertiser on podcasts for the last 30 years. But also, like, you hear the camps of supplementation is really important. It can help. You also hear the camps of like, it's pretty much like you're just expensive, the most expensive pee you're ever going to take because all that just washes through you. And even more specific, like recently, some kind of more pointed critiques about AG1 and what's in there and stuff. Anyway, I'd love, like, you know this space really well. What are your thoughts? And I think I know the answer, but thoughts on supplementation and also AG1 in particular, I'd be curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think supplementation is like incredibly important. Like if by almost any metric you look at the nutrient density of our food, you know, our crops, like the food in our food system is like vastly almost 50% less nutrient dense on average than it was like 70 years ago. And so I think that there are also like a lot of cases of someone having, you know, behavioral disorders, having like different inflammatory markers and things like that. And like taking a methylated B vitamin or, you know, fish oil supplements or any number of these things statistically significantly like help. And there are thousands of clinical trials and other studies out there that show the efficacy of different types of supplementation. And so I think it's a really important thing as a baseline. I think it is even more important if you are, you know, trying to like treat or address specific disease conditions. And so I'm like a big fan of supplementation. I think sometimes people go overboard. I think quality really matters. But yeah, I do think that it's an important part of like anyone's sort of health stack, which kind of to the AG1 point, I think that optimally people are getting almost everything they need from like whole food sources. I think unfortunately most people, that's not the case. Like most people are just not getting their entire, you know, nutrient, macro, micronutrient load that they need from whole food sources. And so for something like an Athletic Greens, I think it is actually quite useful to take on a regular basis. I do think, you know, with some of the pointed criticisms that have been leveled towards them, I think that they probably would be great if they were more transparent around, you know, like the exact like dosing and amount and everything like that that's in their product. But I take it and I think it's like actually a very useful sort of cover a lot of your bases type thing. Especially because they've started to incorporate probiotics and like other mushroom and adaptogens into the sort of AG like one daily thing. And so I tend to think it's like a very useful product for people to just like cover their sort of daily nutritional bases.
Nice. This is where I tell people to go to a certain URL with my affiliate kickback code and buy AG1. So it'll be in the show notes.
Nice. You have one too?
No. I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding.
I know. That'd be... They're everywhere.
Let's take your entire statement and cut it off right at the knees. Supplementation is interesting. For people who listen, there was a podcast I did, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago, did some blood work. And sometimes the stuff you would think you're fine on, it's not always intuitive. Like I live in Tucson, get a lot of sun, but I was deficient in vitamin D, which totally shocked me, and like was deficient in salt. So the doctor who went through the blood work was like, yeah, I mean, load up on the salt, man, like salt all your food, which is like exactly the opposite of what most people would tell you. So I think it's so interesting. You have a business that is focused on something that you're deeply passionate about, the health and wellness space. And so probably our conversation will probably oscillate between like health, wellness, and also business building and stuff. But I have this idea and kind of this thesis about the world. I want to see what you think about. I thought like 10 years ago, I used to think that following a passion or being deeply passionate about your niche was not that important. And maybe even sometimes a liability because you couldn't be objective about it. But I fast forward to like 2024, and I feel like because things have got so much more competitive, because people storytelling is more important, because just it's harder than it used to be that passion can help you stand out more, have a better product, all these things, that actually being deeply passionate about your product is a huge advantage, much more than it was 10 years ago. And I see that in you, like what you've done with Kettle on Fire and your health. Anyway, would you agree, disagree with that, and to what extent?
Oh, I 100% agree. I think I think I would agree for a different reason, though. The thing like that I have thought about from a working on a problem that you're passionate about or a space that you're like just fundamentally like deeply interested in, I think it's less like storytelling, although that helps. And I think it's some of that. I think it's actually just like a math equation. Like for me, because I'm actually interested in this topic of like health, wellness, food systems, stuff like that. Like I basically spend so many of my waking hours, like, you know, and when I'm off the clock, I'm not working. I'm like reading a book on nutrition, or I'm reading a book on like, I've recently finished a book again in my free time called To Die For, which was talking about the toxic load that's in like a bunch of our clothing and stuff like that. And like, there's no immediate business application of that. There's no like thing that I'm like, I'm reading this book for TrueMed, you know, or for Kettle and Fire or whatever, but it just is increasing my body of knowledge. And, you know, then I connect with people over these topics. I like get introduced to people all the time who are interested in health and wellness and this kind of stuff. And I just think if the like more tightly coupled your interests are with your normal life and your business life, you just get all of the access to like connections, other people, information, people that are building stuff on the frontier, on the edge of a given space, almost for free. And it means that I get to like work way more than other people, just because like my work also is my life and it feels like play. You know, it's like this kind of mishmash of things. And I like previously, I started my career buying different like software as a service companies. And that, like, as soon as I was off the clock, I was off the clock. I was like not reading about SaaS. I was not reading about like, you know, small cap M&A. I was like, this is done. I don't care about this. And this is like the total opposite. And I have been really kind of floored by the benefits and just by how much amazing stuff has come from me doing these, you know, doing the off the clock stuff and how it's had a positive impact in my life generally.
Interesting. I got to ask on the SaaS side, you have so many people in e-commerce. This is just human nature. Grass is always greener. But in e-commerce particularly, all of online has gotten harder, but I think e-commerce in particular has seen some of those headwinds.
Yep.
How did you like running a SaaS business versus an e-commerce business? Maybe you can even take, the interest level. I'm guessing your SaaS businesses were not related to health and wellness. Maybe they were.
No.
But as if you can be objective about just business model wise, yeah, which one did you like better?
Oh man, I mean, from a pure business model standpoint, SaaS is way better. Like I think that e-commerce is not an easy way to like make a buck. And if you have the options and you're purely optimizing for making money, SaaS is like so much better. I mean, basically we were buying small companies in the developer tool space. We would buy them. We would raise prices a little bit. People wouldn't churn. And then, you know, we had these like very profitable businesses with no fixed costs, no inventory, no anything. I also personally bought a software company that I bought personally, and it was doing like $1 million a year with one person working part-time, and it was just like 90%+ profit margin. And that kind of doesn't exist in the e-commerce world. And the minute it does, like all of your Amazon competitors basically are like, oh, I should copy that and do it immediately. So that said, in most cases, I think SaaS is a much better business. But I do think that where SaaS often falls down, or like something that I've experienced, is if you can get over the hump and get to like 10 million in sales or so from an e-commerce standpoint, if you can build out a retail channel, you can, you know, like these sorts of things that we've done with Kettle and Fire, like we've actually created, I think, a lot of value in a brand that people are very attached to. And that business has just continued to grow for, you know, 8 years now. And I think that the trade is like e-commerce, you have to get insanely good at marketing and always being good at like messaging, channels, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the product is sort of finished. Like once you have a formula, you're just making the product and you're doing that all the time. With SaaS, it's sort of like the product is never finished, assuming you want to continue to like compound and grow it. And marketing is very hard. So I think there's trade-offs like in anything, but if you're pure business, it's like SaaS is a much better business. If you are like a product person and you just love creating products for individual consumers that feel like they're resonating with what you're making in the world, it's really hard to beat e-commerce and just putting something like amazing into the world.
Yeah. I know people that I've read and talked to said you're a phenomenal marketer. I'd love to know like how marketing has changed for you over the years, because you started Kettle and Fire, I think, in 2014. Is that correct?
2015.
So almost a decade ago. And I was looking looking through kind of your your marketing footprint, which is not always obvious, but you know, YouTube doesn't seem to be too big, or TikTok or Twitter. Instagram's kind of medium, like meaningful presence there, 100,000 people. But how have you grown it from a marketing perspective, and how has that changed over the years? Because it sounds like retail has been a huge part of that too.
Yeah, I mean, that business specifically has shifted quite a lot. Like we started just online. We then decided, this was, 2015, 2016. In 2016, we basically saw that we were the only bone broth that were using really high quality ingredients. We had crazy resonance with this like paleo ancestral health kind of community that I was and am a believer in and was a part of. And all of these influencers didn't have like a bone broth product that they were talking about. And so in 2016, we decided to raise a small bit of money from a bunch of these influencers and basically have them promote us and be like, yeah, we're standing behind Kettle and Fire as our bone broth. And in a sense, like box out a lot of the potential competitors that were to follow, where we had a lot of core influencers that were talking about us as like the bone broth in the space. And once we landed some of those influencers, one of them was promoting our product and one of the buyers at Whole Foods saw it. And so in 2016, they like brought it into 50 Whole Foods. The product sold really well, partially because we had all of this influencer support. And then we went Whole Foods national. And you know, in 2016, 2017, 15% of our business was retail. Now it's about 90% of our business is retail. And that's not because e-commerce sucks. It's just because at the end of the day, buying a $7 box of bone broth is just like most people are shopping for that in stores, not online. It's a repeat purchase item. So the buying experience is just better in retail. And so I kind of like, I think that we did a couple things right there. We looked at how are people making buying decisions in this channel and saw that influencers were driving a lot of purchases and also were not saturated specifically for our product category, and then tried to lock up that channel as much as we could. And then we also moved aggressively into new channels when we had the opportunity with, you know, with moving into retail. With Perfect Keto, you know, we kind of took a similar strategy. Perfect Keto is a company I started and we launched in 2017 with my co-founder, Anthony. And that business like grew like crazy. That was sort of on the backs of, if Kettle and Fire was like influencers in retail, Perfect Keto was sort of like influencers and SEO, where we very early on saw that there was a ton of search volume for keto related things. This is 2017. No one knew what this was. And almost no one like putting like really high quality traffic there. And so really high quality content. And so we invested a ton of time and energy just building out this like 1,000+ page, you know, blog posts, articles, resources, everything, library of content. And at the top of sort of the keto trend in, you know, early 2019, mid 2019, we were getting like 3 to 4 million hits a month on our YouTube, on our content pages, which was massive for us. So between that and influencers, like we bootstrapped that brand and we were doing like our third year in business, we did about 60 million in revenue, which was crazy.
That's insane.
It was also a trend, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you still got to be able to build a
definitely
build a cart that's not going to fall apart being hitched to the rocket ship. So, Kettle and Fire, you said early on you went and you raised money from a bunch of influencers. So, did you give them actual equity in the business?
Yeah.
How did that? This is super geeky, but I'm curious. From a mechanical, were you a C corp and you issued them actual shares in the business, and how important do you think that was? I mean, was that just absolutely pivotal to the success of having to take off like that?
I think it was pretty important. I mean, so yeah, we were a C corp and we basically did two things. We raised some money because we were growing very quickly and it was just good to have like a backstop. Also from, you know, when I launched, I was like, this will be a lifestyle business, you know, and after a sort of period of time, got more confident that this was a big enough opportunity that it meant we should probably consider raising at least some amount of money. So we raised 800 grand in 2016, not very much. Because I was like, no matter what, like even if we sell for like 20 million, like, you know, this size of raise will support that size of exit. I think it was really important for us to do for a couple reasons. Like the money just candidly meant that we could take more swings from a marketing standpoint. Like we invested in Tim Ferriss's podcast and advertising on that, Joe Rogan's podcast and advertising on that in 2016, 2017, when like people didn't know what bone broth was. And, you know, those were both like 70 to 80K media buys, if I remember correctly. And that was really useful to like grow the category. The most useful thing though, I do think, was we had these influencers come on and we said, hey, if you are going to promote our product, basically, we'll pay you a commission, just like any sort of affiliate influencer deal, but we'll also give you a a chunk of equity for like all of the sales that you drive. So if you drive like $100,000 in commission, where we're paying you like, you know, paid cash commission, we'll also give you like another 50 grand, 100 grand in equity, whatever it was. And I think that that was really useful because it meant that we had these influencers that are like often in conversation who are sort of aligned in like growing Kettle and Fire equity value. And for me, it meant that, you know, I have people like Mark Sisson and Ben Greenfield and Wellness Mama that are talking about what we're doing and incentivized to grow the pie for us. And like, I get to be the beneficiary of most of that. I mean, I have to run and grow the business and do a good job doing that. And for them, they're like, great, I get to talk about a high quality product that I believe in. And, you know, if things go really well, which they have, like, it'll be a pretty material outcome for me. And so I do think that was like a pretty good, it's something that I'm like very glad that we did in retrospect.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Did you have to spend a lot of time, were you a known entity at the point when you approached those influencers and kind of pitched them on your product? Or did you have to do a lot of education alongside of the carrot of the commission and the equity to get them on board?
We had to do a fair bit of education. We had some relationships that like, and at that point, like knew some people in common that made these introductions and kind of had a vouch and everything like that. But for a lot of these people that like very much believe in the ancestral health principles, a lot of them were talking about bone broth quite a bit, but they were talking about it from the standpoint of like, you know, making it at home or like, here's why you should incorporate this thing in your diet. And the reality is for most Americans, no one's like, man, I really have like a spare couple hours, you know, a couple times a week that I would love to use like making bone broth or something like that. And so when we sort of had this product that fit with a topic they had already been talking to their audience about and that they could actually, you know, monetize by promoting to their audience, I think that that was just like a good sort of product channel influencer fit that meant that they ended up talking about it quite a lot.
Yeah. And I didn't cover this at the top and kind of embarrassing to say. What's the sales pitch on bone broth? Like for people listening, myself included, who are kind of maybe a little familiar with it, it sounds healthy-ish. It sounds, you know, but what, like why, it, to me, I think like, okay, this is like chicken soup, you know, kind of stock that's maybe has some health benefits, but what's the, you build a whole brand about it. Why is it so powerful?
Yeah. So a couple things. It is one, an incredible source of collagen. It's also a source of full spectrum amino acids. And so if you are the average American, mostly what you're eating when you eat animal protein is you're eating like cuts of muscle meat. So, you know, steak, chicken breast, things like that. That is great. It's very high protein, but you're missing sort of like the many of the amino acids, collagen, multi types of collagen, glycine, and the like that are mostly present in like the connective tissues and in organ meats. And so if these things like are literally the building blocks of your gut, skin, and joints, they are massively helpful for skin health, inflammation, leaky gut, like all these sorts of things. And also as a society, like we basically have never before consumed so much protein and so much meat without also consuming these different amino acids that help with digestion, that help with like rebuilding some of the connective tissue and things like that in your body. And so I think that if you are to make one or two interventions from a like health standpoint, consuming a lot of these collagens and amino acids in the form of, in their most bioavailable form, i.e. bone broth on a regular basis, is like a very strong nutritional intervention that a lot of people are using. And if you look, like every culture throughout history basically has had a sort of like cultural food of eating some sort of like bone, you know, bone broth or connective tissue that has been cooked for a long period of time. Like the reason that people are like, oh yeah, you know, when you get a cold, like have chicken noodle soup, it's not because of like the noodles or the chicken, it's because it's like cooked in this, you know, basically bone broth. And now, you know, since basically the 1970s, Campbell's and a bunch of the other big food companies don't actually use real bones in making these like ancestral and very culturally relevant food products. And so in my view, like bone broth is a sort of a nutritional powerhouse that we are trying to bring back into the American diet.
It's interesting. I read through, you've got a fantastic newsletter we'll talk about here in a few minutes. Really well researched, really, you know, in depth, well cited scientifically, which I thought was really cool. Some of the stats in there are kind of mind boggling, but one thing that stood out to me was the ingredient list difference between ketchup in America versus ketchup in the UK, right? In terms of just all the fillers, the corn syrup versus the UK. I'm kind of simplifying here, but it was pretty much like salt, tomatoes, you know, it was pretty straightforward. that's such a huge part of why you're doing this, because you think the food system. So you're kind of big. The reason, one of the reasons you're passionate about what you do and one of your beliefs about the world is just that, is that the food system, especially in the US, is just deeply broken, right?
I think it's poisonous. Yeah.
Yeah. How would you, so what would you do to change that? Like, I mean, obviously there's all these farm stuff. Why are all these farm stuff? Because the thesis, I think a lot of people know this, but just very high level, we subsidize so many things like corn and soy. And so there's all these excess crops that we use to pretty much, not because they're great, but we use it to put them into everything. Why don't we subsidize things like fresh fruit? Why is it so hard to get the farm bill changed when it's obviously a win for almost everybody? Like, why has this been such a, given it seems like such a huge problem with far-reaching implications, why has it lingered around for so long?
Yeah, it's a great question. To answer the second part of that question, I think why has it lingered? I think the reason is that, you know, today we have a system that subsidizes anywhere in the range of like $4 to $6 billion a year, three main like cash crops, staple crops, corn, soy, wheat. And because these products are subsidized, they're artificially cheap. And because they're artificially cheap, they get into everything. Like, this is why Coca-Cola uses high fructose corn syrup rather than sugar. It's why, you know, soybean oil is in everything and accounts by some measures for almost 20% of the average American's daily caloric intake is in the form of soybean oil. It's not because like there's raving fanatics who love soybean oil or anything like this. It's because like this stuff is cheap. It's an oil and it acts as a binder. And so it's in everything. And like, this is, I think, one of the original sins, in a sense, of our food system, is we initially had a, you know, like a bunch of these subsidies that came about post-World War II, mostly in an effort to encourage sort of stability. Like, there were some bad weather swings and farmers lost their crops and all sorts of stuff. And there was this big effort to introduce this program that made it, try to introduce like price stability, basically. So if you're a farmer, you know, we're going to introduce this sort of crop insurance program and these subsidies that make it impossible effectively for you to lose money when you grow these products. Now, you're not making almost any money, but it's impossible to lose it. And so they subsidize the creation of these corn, soy, wheat generally. That's where most of these subsidies go. Because of that, most farmers converted to large farms that are almost exclusively growing corn, soy, wheat. And because they're almost exclusively growing corn, soy, and wheat in these massive monocrop sort of operations, they also are investing a ton of money in genetically modifying these crops and to make sure that their yields are high, they're like pest resistant, all this stuff, and also spraying them with like more pesticides than any other type of crop that exists. And as a result of this, roll this forward, you know, 40 years now, you basically just, we have a system where many of the crops that are grown in the US are these sorts of three staple crops. Almost none of them are used for human consumption, which is crazy. Like, we're basically, as taxpayers, paying to have these massive companies and massive farms grow these sort of three crops. Most of them don't actually go towards human consumption at all. And then the ones that do are go towards like food that we eat in their most highly processed form. This is why, you know, in some cases, a like Twinkies and other very processed foods are worse for you than like the real thing. It's not because, it's because the inputs of these fake Frankenfoods are cheaper than the actual input costs of, you know, just growing things like normally or the real way, I would say. And I think that this is one of the biggest things that just needs to change in our food system, period. And why it won't is because you currently have a bunch of these companies that know how to lobby and they know how to tell stories in DC and make sure that this sort of like cash cow of this multi-billion dollar a year subsidy just doesn't change and doesn't like impact them. Like, Bayer Monsanto makes a ton of money selling seed and fertilizer to these large farmers that are basically growing these sorts of cash crops. They're very much not incentivized for a free market where, you know, consumers can basically make choices that say, maybe I don't want the most processed version of X, Y, or Z product, or maybe I want to buy more fruits rather than, you know, something with corn, soy, and wheat. They're basically making a ton of money, and they know how to use lobbying to prevent that from happening. Very unfortunately. I really do think this is like one of the highest leverage interventions that we could make. And the last thing I'll say on this too is just to give you a sense of how messed up the farm bill is and the subsidies thing, is tobacco gets four times more subsidies than fruits and vegetables. Like, it's, which is just like, what? Like, I didn't think that anyone wanted to subsidize tobacco. What is going on?
I saw that in your newsletter, and that was one of the stats I wrote down that just blew me away. It seems like, I mean, if you were you know, President Mayors came in and had executive, you know, your first day in office, you're like, okay, I'm going to be around for a month. I'm going to write a bunch of wildly controversial executive orders. would 90% of it be, you know, getting rid of the subsidies, subsidizing fresh fruit, vegetables, you know, other healthy foods? I feel like part of it too, I feel like this is part of so many things, whether you look at like the medical system or you look at AI or you look at the healthcare system, is looking at the people who are going to lose and say, hey, we realize you have a massive vested interest here in keeping the status quo. We can't keep the status quo forever, but we're going to at least have a gradual walk down where you're not going to lose everything, like, you know, just immediately. So maybe to farmers, be like, hey, we're going to phase this out over 10 years, or we're going to give you, you know, tax credits to do other things. Because I feel like that's a huge part of so many big changes that are not thought of. Is like, yes, the end state would be better in X, but how do we get the people who are going to not benefit from that change on board with this thing that's not good for them, but is good for the whole society?
Totally. Yeah, I think that doing something like that would be important and useful. I do think though that there is this like insidious element of, you know, our current system, frankly, is if we were to change things tomorrow and say like, hey, subsidies are done starting tomorrow. It's not like individual, like when you say farmers, you think of like small mom and pop operation that is going to lose out and they're like lovingly growing their, you know, their corn, soy, and wheat and getting paid subsidies to do so. Not at all the case of what's happening. Like almost like 70% of these subsidies are going towards massive corporations that have spent tons of money working on corn, soy, and wheat and generally end up exporting many of these products or selling them to be turned into like ethanol in the case of corn, or, you know, or biodiesel, or soybean oil, or animal feed, or whatever. Like, I think that yes, it may be useful to have some sort of transition period for a lot of these. But my view is that a lot of what's happened and a lot of what is making, you know, like what is wrong in the U.S. today is that you have a sort of cohort of small special interests, like these farmers, like these chemical fertilizer companies, like many of these seed companies and the like. And many of the big food companies, that would a change hurt their bottom lines? Yes. But our sort of status quo is that these companies get to make a bunch of money and are very profitable. And then they externalize the cost of creating sick, unhealthy Americans onto the US taxpayer via the US healthcare system. And if that is the equilibrium, like I just think that it is a moral imperative that we shift the economic burden of, you know, making less money. Like, sure, yes, maybe Campbell's or Coca-Cola or whoever is slightly less profitable. But if that results in, you know, not having the sickest generation of Americans that we've ever seen, not having record high healthcare costs, like I think the math massively pencils out. And I think that the thing we can't keep doing is cannot continue to privilege special interests at the expense of literally having the sickest generation of Americans that we've ever seen and are currently on a path to bankrupt the US if from a healthcare cost standpoint, if things don't get better. And like fundamentally, this is where I kind of disagree with a lot of healthcare people, economists like this. Like people talk about healthcare costs are going up. Yes, sure. They definitely are. Healthcare in the US is expensive and needs to be way better. That said, almost no one is talking about the fundamental thing, which is like, we are sick as a country and the average American is sick and has a lot of issues. And if we took levels of chronic disease back to where they were in 1970, healthcare would not be approaching 20% of GDP. It would be about 4%. And like that, I think, is the core thing. Like we can debate healthcare costs all we want, but my opinion, the biggest thing is like, we just cannot have a healthy country made up of sick people. And that's effectively where we are today.
Hey, it's Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to David, who's the owner of dropguys.com, where they make super heavy duty phone cases. He's a newer member to eCommerce Fuel, and here's what he had to say about his experience with our vetted private community for 7- and 8-figure owners.
My favorite aspect of eCommerce Fuel is the community. The reason being is because having gone through the membership application process, I know that everyone is verified, everyone is legit, and everyone's very transparent. Whereas on other communities, such as Reddit, Twitter, you don't really know how much authority they have, how much success they have had, and whether how much weight to give to their opinions. Whereas on eCommerce Fuel, you know they're tried and tested, and you can act on their advice with confidence.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their seven or eight figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Yeah, it does seem like there's a lot more interest. Maybe it's just in entrepreneurial circles. Maybe it's just, kind of me noticing it because I'm more interested in it. But it does seem like there's much more of a focus on preventative medicine, on health. It was reactive for so long in the US, and I don't know about the rest of the Western world, but it seems like there's more and more people thinking about this more carefully from a proactive perspective, as opposed to let's just treat the disease. And from, you know, and from a health food perspective, like you're talking about. Have you seen that? Like, do you feel like we're headed in the right direction?
I don't feel like we're headed in the right direction, but I do feel like this is a movement that is starting to come about. I mean, if healthcare spend around $4 trillion a year, would you guess how much goes towards prevention?
Oh, I love these games. I would say $4 trillion. I'm going to say sub 5% goes towards prevention.
Yeah. So it's about 1%. Oh my gosh. 1% of the entire $4 trillion goes towards prevention and wellness. And the reason for this is because, you know, again, like our current healthcare system is built, it was basically like built and constructed post-World War II, where the default assumptions going into it is like the average person is healthy, they get sick, they break a leg, they get pneumonia, they like do something, they go into our healthcare system, health insurance pays to get them healthy, and they exit the system, they're healthy again. Those assumptions are like no longer true. Like 85% of all healthcare spend goes towards managing, not treating, not preventing, not like curing chronic disease, just managing it. And by managing, we mean like someone has diabetes, they have hypertension, they have any number of these things, and they go through, you know, a litany of pills, prescriptions, and other procedures over their lifetime to manage these chronic conditions. That's 85% of our healthcare spend. And so the default assumption should no longer be the average American is healthy, they get sick, the system then helps them exit the system again back to a state of health. What we're actually seeing is the average person is sick and they stay in the system forever. That person existing in the system is the most profitable consumer of healthcare that exists, basically. And so I am seeing and starting to see people maybe wake up and start to like take their health into their own hands. But I think that that's what you have to do when you're in a system that is just so fundamentally broken, and a system where the incentives nudge you towards becoming a consumer of the service of healthcare, not like, you know, and thus, you know, being a very profitable customer of theirs, as opposed to being someone that takes their health into their own hands and kind of takes control. And I think that, unfortunately, the dynamic this creates, because there are no or very, very few structural players in our entire healthcare and food system that are incentivized for you to be in good health, what this means is that basically the only people that are taking control of their own health are the ones who can afford that, that have the means, that can pay, you know, for concierge doctors, supplements, exercise, things like that. And so when people say like, I do think people are starting to wake up to the problems here. I also think that we are probably on the cusp of creating or furthering a situation that we already have, which is like, to be healthy requires having an excess of resources, and you're going to have two classes of society. One that is can afford to like look out for their own care, invest in their own health and things like that, and one that can't and like massively suffer as a consequence.
Yeah, that's really sad. Justin for President 2024.com. You can go there to donate. We still got 3-4 months, man. You're under 80, right? You're under 78. Is that fair? Yeah. I'm gonna guess, go out on a limb and say so. I want to ask you about what you've learned with retail. What are some of the big lessons and takeaways there? I know it drives like 80-90% of Kettle and Fire. I'm not sure about the keto business, if it's as big
Nothing.
Of a player. Nothing. Interesting. No, is that mostly
just e-commerce?
I'd love to hear your thoughts, especially on like pros and cons of a very retail heavy approach versus an online driven DTC approach, because I feel like we're in this space, in an environment right now where, and validly too, where just online is getting way more expensive, ad prices are up, attention is harder to get, and people are kind of trying to push towards retail distribution because it's relatively easier maybe, or at least they think it is. But for people who haven't done it, retail comes with its own entire can of worms in terms of all sorts of stuff. So I'd love to hear your take, like pros, cons, which ones you know, pros, cons between the two? And then also, do you think retail is more advantageous going forward? You're in a pretty unique position to answer that.
Yeah, I think it really depends on what you want to do and the scale of the category that you're operating in. And so what I mean by that, so Kettle and Fire, we moved into retail. We are selling a sub $10 product in a category where like 90, that is like firmly a grocery product. And so because it's grocery, you know, 90% of all grocery dollars still today are spent in retail. And so for us, you know, we're looking at low price per product. People are often buying this in combination with other trips to the grocery store. Very few people are like running to the grocery store solely to like stock up on bone broth or, you know, something like that. And so for us, like, we're like, okay, the consumer is in retail for this category. And this is the type of thing that people are just going to add to their basket as they're doing like a larger shopping trip. And we were pretty confident that that was where we needed to end up over the long term. So we scaled the business to like 7-ish million online in our first like 2.5 years, and which was great. But like we started to invest in retail, and what we saw, especially as ad costs continue to go up, especially as the consumer buying experience, frankly, again, was just better at retail. Many people were buying on subscription, you know, 6 boxes of bone broth per month. That kind of adds up. Like if you're not cooking through that every single month, the sort of purchasing behavior is at odds with how consumers actually use the product, which was tough. And so we decided to invest much more in retail. Retail is a very hard game to get into. For us, I think it worked because we're moving into a large category where consumers are already shopping the set. You know, the broth and stock category is like in the billions of dollars. The soup category is even larger. And so we felt that the category could support it. And if you walk down the center aisle in the broth and soup category, there basically been no new entrants in that space for a while. And so our retailer partners were looking at us going, bone broth, people are spending a premium relative to like the existing broth and stock space. So when someone buys Kettle and Fire at $7 versus like some other brand at a $3 price point, that retailer makes more. And so if they want consumers to spend more on that shelf item, they're going to place us there all day, assuming consumers will buy. So category was big enough. Retailers were excited about us bringing innovation to the category, and it fit with our consumer, like where our consumer's behavior pattern was. That said, we'd actually had to raise more money to support our retail push. So we raised about $10 million more in 2018 and basically did that because retail is brutal to get going. Like when we started shifting into retail, we had to get good at managing cash flow. Like we would make a product, sell it to a retailer or sell it to a distributor, and then get paid like 30 to 45 days later. A lot of the retailers, at least in our space, in the food space, are somewhat notorious for chargebacks, for like inappropriate deductions, for like this whole universe of things that's like frankly really annoying to deal with. And we continue to scale our retail business, and basically we're a break-even, a slightly unprofitable business for the first like 2 to 3 years while we built that channel. It's only now after 6 years basically of really investing in the retail channel that it is a like profitable, really solid channel for us, because we've like built and gotten enough distribution. We're at good eye level for this category. We've gotten into like most of the retailers we want to get into. The other thing about retail, and this is like another challenge, is it's slow. Like most retailers do a single category review each year. And so each year, like we would crush Whole Foods. We would sell amazingly. Then the next category review, they'd go, great, you got Whole Foods National. We get into Whole Foods National. Our numbers are really good. Then we'd have to sell into Kroger National. And like that's a, you know, 12-month sales cycle. And then we're in every Kroger. And so you're just sort of like, even in a best case scenario, stair-stepping up every like 6 to 12 to 18 months the number of retailers that you're getting in. And if you don't perform in any of those retailers as you go from like small specialty to large like national chains like Walmart, Target, Kroger, and the like, you basically get pulled out in the next, within like a year or two. And so it's a hard business. I also think it tends to be very durable. Like once you're in retail and performing, it's kind of hard to get ripped off shelves. Like you're just not going to lose that shelf space if you're performing in the top 50%. But I do think that it works much better for lower price products in staple categories than it does for a specialty item like Perfect Keto. So like Perfect Keto, you know, everyone is going to buy bone broth, or everyone's buying broth in stock. The question is, are you going to trade up for Kettle and Fire bone broth, or are you going to buy, you know, normal stuff? for Perfect Keto, not everyone is buying like keto supplements and keto focused snacks. So we tried to go into retail. We probably spent like about $1.5 million trying to go into retail and just found that it wasn't like a mass market appeal category quite enough where we could put it on shelves and it would just move in the top 50%. And so for us, like that business is going to be much better, I think, as a direct to consumer brand where we can like tell the story, talk to our customers, all these sorts of things. Kettle and Fire, we knew we had to scale into retail and had to win there or else some other brand was going to. I'm not really convinced that another brand is going to win in building like a big keto supplement and snacks brand in retail just because it's like a pretty specialty item.
Yeah, that makes total sense. When you talk about it took 5-6 years to start making money on the Kettle and Fire side for retail, and you spend $1.5 million trying to get the keto business in, what are you spending that money on? Is it just manpower and team power to call people? Is it iterating on package designs? Is it like lower prices to make it easier for those retailers to bring you in? Like, what are you spending the money on?
Yeah. So a lot of it, like a fair bit is lower prices to distributors. A lot of it is like slotting fees and basically these sort of marketing fees that you need to pay to move into these different retailers. And so, for example, when we were trying to sell into like Sprouts or something like that, Sprouts is like, great, we'll bring you in. We require though some marketing support. So you need to spend, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 here to be in our national catalog that is like going to get in front of distributors. We need you to run a 2-for-1 sort of buy one, get one promotion during this period for this product. And so you know, much like you launch a product and you're only halfway there, like you have to spend a bunch of money marketing the product in e-commerce land. Marketing the product in retail just looks like paying these retailers quite a lot of money to promote and like make consumers aware or try and incentivize them to try the product that they just brought in. And frankly, that's where a lot of retailers, not all of them, but a fair number, like Sprouts is one of these, many Kroger brands are like this. They make most of their margin on brands paying them this marketing fee more than they do on like actually selling groceries and other products, which is pretty interesting. And so that's kind of the game that you end up playing. So for Perfect Keto, yeah, it was like manpower to staff up and run this channel and then quite a lot of marketing investments to see if the product would actually move once we got in there.
So for everyone thinking, I'm sick of Facebook, I'm sick of Google paying money to advertise, I'm going to go to retail and they're just going to roll it out on a silver platter to the masses. Maybe not quite so straightforward.
No, definitely not. Yeah. Now that said, it does work. Like Kettle and Fire, we still pay to promote, you know, years into our brands at these different retailers. You just have to, frankly. But at a certain point, like we can also guarantee that there's going to be some level of sales activity in that channel and that we're going to move pretty well, even non-promoted.
Got it. What did you learn about package design in that whole process? Because I imagine, I mean, you have people that know you, that love you, come in, they'll grab it off the shelf, even if it looked like it was, you know, drawn by crayon because they trust your branding. A lot of people I think about when I wine shop, I know nothing about wine, right? Like I know you have a wine business as well, a non-alcoholic wine business. I know a decent amount about beer, nothing about wine. I'm a label shopper, apart from like the blends, which I know a lot of other people are too, even if they don't admit it. What did you learn about package design in terms of retail space that worked and didn't work?
It's really tough. We had the benefit of testing different packaging stuff online, basically, and using those learnings to roll into retail and to see what would actually resonate with consumers. That, I think, is a huge advantage. Otherwise, your iteration and learning cycles on this packaging stuff is just so slow. What we saw that works is basically with Kettle and Fire, we're like, let's be very differentiated from the category. The entire category was like, you know, beige, yellow kind of colors. We went with like a very strong black differentiated color. The entire category was kind of had nebulous claims from a health and nutrition standpoint. We were like grams of collagen, grams of protein, you know, glyphosate free, Whole30 approved, just like all of the things that we thought our consumers would resonate with. But really, I mean, I think that the challenge in retail is how can you build a brand and a package that very quickly, within 2 seconds of looking at it from 6 feet away, someone gets a sense of like, here are the reasons that you should buy this product. And that is like what we have spent so much of our time and energy and money testing from a packaging standpoint. And frankly, I think like something that we didn't do well enough with Perfect Keto where the packaging for our stuff, we built it as direct to consumer brand, and moving into retail probably didn't test it enough. If I could redo that process again, I would call like the products that we were making either collagen bars or make like a zero carb or zero, you know, low net carb kind of claim very, very prominent on pack, rather than this like somewhat nebulous keto terminology that consumers, many of them, didn't totally understand. Like, it's quite possible Perfect Keto as a low carb bar, no sugar bar could have worked in retail, but the way that we did it, it was just Perfect Keto, and people are like, I don't really know what this keto thing is, or I'm not keto, that's not for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Your newsletter, you have a newsletter called The Next, which I mentioned earlier, is fantastic. Justinmares.substack.com if you want to check it out and get on there. I'd love to hear like what you've learned on doing a newsletter and building it and kind of grow an audience that way. That's something I'm trying to invest more time in. And maybe first question is, why Substack versus like your own, attaching it to your own blog or something like that? Like, you've got all these different places. Why, you know, how do you think about where to host it? And is it that important?
Yeah. So quick answer on the host thing. Substack, super easy. I'm lazy. And this is like not my primary thing, like doing the influencer thing. And, yeah. And then secondly, Substack has this amazing like suggestions feature where they're building this network of people that want to read content that resonates with them. And so if I'm like just on my own blog, I'm like constrained by the number of people that I can drive to my blog through Twitter and other stuff like that. Substack has probably been responsible for like 20 to 30% of my total subscribers, which is really, really useful. And so that's a big reason why. It's also free. So for all those reasons, I think it's like a good deal for me right now. What I have found doing the newsletter, I think that still, I would say two things have been really surprising. One, I write a monthly newsletter. This is not like a, you know, I'm not like trying to like be a hyper influencer and tweet like 100 times a day, write 10 newsletters a week, anything like that. Like, this is very much a thing that I do on the side because I like it and because like I want to slowly improve my craft of writing and talk about the topics that I do around health, startups, and the like. The things that I've been surprised by is that a newsletter is such a personal thing. Like, you build this amazing relationship with an audience. Even at like 1,000 subscribers, I was shocked by the number of people and like interesting people and interesting opportunities that got surfaced to me just by writing this newsletter on a monthly basis. Like, now that we're, you know, much, much more than that from a subscriber count standpoint, even now I'm like, wow, I'm just meeting amazing people that care exactly about the topic that I care about all the time. Like, that is so cool. And I think that it is this incredible way to build an ongoing relationship, sort of talk about the things that you talk about with 12,000 people at a time. The last thing I would say too is that I've been really surprised by how useful it is, even as like a way to create a high amount of context with people that I know or work with professionally, where I've gone to meetings where someone will be like, oh, I just read your recent posts. Like, so cool that X, Y, and Z is happening, or that you're digging into this topic or whatever. And it creates this much closer kind of relationship that I think is like very, very hard to put a price on, but feels to me very valuable. Like, I've 4 years or 5 years into writing my newsletter, I guess, yeah, 4.5. And I'm like still consistently amazed by how many amazing people I meet from it, the random opportunities that come from writing that post or from writing monthly, and just like what a positive thing it is in my life, even though I am probably doing a 2 out of 10 job out of, you know, at what I think I could be doing from a newsletter standpoint, just because I'm purely time constrained.
Yeah. I mean, it's you're maintaining, building and maintaining rapport at scale is kind of what you're doing now, which is super valuable. And 2 out of 10, I mean, I would disagree. I mean, the newsletter that you wrote that I read before we hopped on here, I would guess 4,000 words, 3,000 words. Like,
that was the longest I've ever run.
It was. Okay. I accidentally stumbled across your pinnacle newsletter, but it was fantastic. And do you sit down usually and write for 2 or 3 hours when you do it? Or what's your process or kind of thought, you know, your methodology for it?
Yeah. So my method, like, I try and keep it fun for me is like a big thing. And so what that means for me is if I get inspired, I'll write a note on my phone. Like, in the next 2 posts, I'm going to write about how the US comes up with like toxin limits, because it's like something I recently learned and I think it's crazy. But so basically I'll like have a topic and I'm like, okay, I want to write about this. And then I will sit down generally like one Saturday morning a week And I'll say that my newsletter generally has three sections, and I'll just be like, okay, I'm going to write about this topic, sit down, crank it out in like an hour. And that's an hour of like blend of research and writing time. And then it's basically it. And then I do that over every Saturday morning, three sections are all written. And the last Saturday, I'll kind of do like a proofread and, you know, edit and then send. And man, I could spend so much time, so much more time writing this thing. Like the last one that I wrote was actually took me like 3 months basically of writing and like very focused, like putting the pieces together, went through multiple edit cycles because I wanted it to be kind of like my manifesto or like longer touch piece of what I think is going on. And that took way more time than my normal one. But normally it's just, yeah, three-ish Saturdays a month. I'm cranking it out and then sending it.
Got it. That's, well, you're doing a great job, man. Would strongly recommend checking it out. Again, I'll put the link in the show notes, but fantastic work. So
I appreciate that.
Two more questions here. We got to start wrapping up, but long journey, you're a venture partner over there. I'd love to hear how you're thinking about investing going forward. And you have like most people investing, they have a background in entrepreneurship and investing. So you have some interesting thoughts on how investing is going to change. People are going to raise less kind of earlier and then just do one raise often. If you could comment on that, and then also kind of what you're looking for to invest in going forward. So if there's anyone who's listening who might be a good fit for you, they can get in touch.
Yeah. So on the first one, I think that investing like is likely to go through somewhat significant change, at least in areas like e-commerce, SaaS, like some of these things that are no longer at the frontier of technology. I think that for the last 20, maybe like 15 years, probably the best bet that you could make as a venture investor was find a space that does not have a B2B SaaS winner and like back it as aggressively as you can. That has led to multiple, you know, deca-billion-dollar companies in the B2B SaaS kind of world. I think that that's going forward. Like SaaS is getting way cheaper to make. It's getting way more competitive. And I think that the size of the outcomes is also coming down. And so when the ceiling is coming down and, you know, you're less likely to see, you know, as many B2B SaaS companies, I think, that are entering the 20 plus billion dollar range as we did the last decade, I think that how you bet on these companies has to change. And I think that we are going to see the rise of companies that raise one, maybe two rounds of funding, use that funding to aggressively build product, own a market, build an amazing thing, but that then are like just going to build and like keep control of the company. Founders don't have to be on the venture treadmill forever, always raising and investing more into marketing and team and all that sort of thing. I think you're going to see a lot more of those like one round companies is kind of what a friend and I have been calling them. On the investing side, like things that I look for, it's hard to describe, but I tend to be pulled in two directions. One, anything around like what I'm calling the great American poisoning, I think is like super interesting. Like things that like—
It sounds so cool, but it's not.
Yeah, exactly. So anything that targets the, you know, massive toxin load that we have today, improves metabolic health, improves our food system, improves like ways that we do agriculture, anything like that. Hell yeah, I'm in, like would love to chat. On the other side of the coin, like I'm also very interested, and this is something Long Journey talks about as a fund, in this idea of what are like magically weird companies, like companies that feel weird, pretty non-consensus. They don't really make a ton of sense to a lot of investors or people today, but that there's a chance in the, you know, next decade, if the founder is right, that there's something really interesting there. Like we were one of the first investors in a company called Rainmaker, which they're using drones to do cloud seeding and try and like influence the weather basically and use atmospheric rivers to like precipitate and rain on various, you know, farms, ski resorts, things like that. That is like a pretty out there idea. It's kind of wild. There's a lot of people are like, well, that won't work for X, Y, and Z reason. That seems crazy for X, Y, and Z reason. And it might be totally crazy. It might totally fail. But I do think that the best investments in general in venture seem to be ones that are often very misunderstood in the early days, but that if you are right, if the founder is right about the way that they see the world, that those are the things that are often cheap in retrospect, where once the thing works, it takes market and consensus a while to catch up. Like the first angel investment I ever did was in this company called Crusoe Energy that was building these like compute rigs basically that they would drop in oil fields and use flared natural gas, which is basically when you pump for oil, natural gas also comes out and they flare it. This is why you see, like, you know, the burning fire sticks in the oil fields of Iraq and stuff like that. So they flare it, they just burn it off because they can't do anything with that natural gas. They like put like a compute rig on top of these flares and use that energy to mine Bitcoin and to like do AI training and stuff like that. And you're like, what a insane idea. And a lot of people said that. A lot of people in 2018 were like, what is this? You know, there's like no way this is an investable company. But because it was so weird, it had a hard time raising money at first. And now that it's worked and has been like proven out, I think the company has raised like $200 million or something and is on an amazing trajectory. And so I think that companies like that, that feel weird, strange, or non-consensus early on, are generally the types of ones that get me very excited.
Very cool. I got to check in on your goals for 2023. I did a little bit of browsing around some of the other ones. And one that stuck out to me, just hit on a couple of these. You biked from Moab to Telluride. You got to tell me about this. It sounds very cool.
Dude, it was awesome. It was one of the best trips I've ever done. It was like a five-day bike trip where my now wife and I, we basically started in Telluride, camped out, and did the bike packing thing for 5 days. And it was so epic. Like, I can't recommend enough getting outside over for a multi-day period, like fully off devices, fully like in nature, being in the backcountry, everything like this. It was just like an unbelievable experience. And 2 days into it, you know, I feel like I'm a relatively busy guy. I have like a lot going on, I feel like, in my head at times. my wife was just like, you feel so different, like taking you away from devices, taking you away from like information inputs, taking you away from like thinking about your businesses in a what's going on today standpoint. She was like, you just feel like a completely different person, way more relaxed, easier to laugh, you know, happier. And I was like, yeah, I really need to do this a couple times a year. Frankly, just being on a bike for hundreds of miles over 5 days was a fantastic way to do it.
Yeah. Have you been doing any other bike packing, or was that your kind of first trip, or have you been getting more into it?
That was my first trip. We're going to do another one this summer, in France, which I'm excited about.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's amazing. The Moab to Telluride itinerary sounds fantastic. I've gotten into bike packing, not a ton, but probably done half a dozen trips over the last 4 or 5 years.
Nice.
And it's yeah, like you said, it's so fantastic. I'll either go with like kids, or I'll go with like 3 or 4 really good buddies. And like you said, it's just, you're out there for anywhere from 2 days to 5 or 6 days. You're really going to unwind and recharge. And there's something about being on a bike. I mean, you hear people say this when they go traveling, like they'll travel the world for a year in a backpack, and they're like, you really don't need anything. But yeah, you get that almost doubly so on a bike for some reason, because you're like, everything I need is on this bike. And granted, you get pretty manky by the time you're back, so I wouldn't recommend like going to like a, you know, a White House dinner at the end of one of these things. But it is cool how little you need, and also how much terrain you can see on a bike in one day. Like the change in landscape in a day on bike, human powered, is pretty spectacular.
Dude, it's awesome. And I don't know what it is, but there's something about campfire conversation, or like sort of like you've been biking all day with the same people, you're eating dinner, sitting around a campfire, just sort of like have nothing to do but chat and chop it up. Mm-hmm. That is just so fun. Like it is so superior, I think, to going out to a restaurant, even with the same six friends. And I don't know what it is, but I just think that like that extended time in nature is so invaluable from a relationship building standpoint. And for those that like are interested in getting started, there's this group called Western Spirit that does these like fully supported bike packing trips, where basically you can just like throw your tent on their truck. They drive it to the next spot where you're going, and all you have to do is show up and bike. And it's awesome.
That sounds amazing. The Moab to Telluride route, was it up and down over mountains, single track? Oh, yeah. Was it kind of more wide? Okay. It was.
Yeah. 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 It was gravel bike. It was like, you know, 300 something miles. And like one day we did 7,000 feet of climb over like, you know, over like 45 or 50 miles. It's a somewhat intense ride, but man, it's so fun. And you can do it with e-bikes. Like it was so cool. It was my wife and I, and then five other people, all who were over the age of 75. And they were all doing it on e-bikes as a friend group. And they were like the happiest group of 75-year-olds I've ever seen in my life. My wife and I were like, this is exactly what we want to be like when we're in our 70s. Like the one woman literally turned 81 on the bike trip.
That's so
cool. And everyone was like, yay, Kathy. It was amazing.
That's so cool. One of the things for me in terms of fitness and health is like when I I've been thankful to have my father was an incredible example of health and just like discipline in terms of eating well and exercising consistently for like 40 years. And now he's in his 70s and like I was mountain biking with him this weekend, right? Like, and seeing people like that, like the 81-year-old you mentioned, I mean, even on an e-bike to be out for 5 days camping at 81, most 81-year-olds are not going to be able to pull that off.
Totally.
Most 65 or 70-year-olds are not going to be able to pull that off.
I don't think either of our presidential candidates could do that right now.
Well, yeah. The third one, Kennedy looks like he might be able to switch.
That's fair.
Maybe not, you know. But yeah, like anyway, so for me, seeing people 60, 70, sometimes even 80s out doing that, for me is such a good motivator on a health perspective
totally.
To try to like keep your body up because it's so inspiring to see that. Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. It was so inspiring. We were like, we want to be these people when we're older. It was so
yes.
great.
Yeah. Last question, inside baseball. What was your bike setup that you were riding with? Was it a hardtail? Was it a gravel bike? What were you riding to your
gravel bike? It was an Ibis Haka.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Okay, cool.
Yeah. It was great. Held up
Very
super
cool.
well.
Very cool. I have a new gravel bike coming today in the mail. So it'll be new bike.
What'd you get?
Which is, I got a Salsa Cutthroat.
Nice, dude. That's awesome.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Tour Divide, that trail that goes from Banff down to Mexico?
No, but it sounds amazing.
You should check this out. So this is a mountain. I think it's one of the longest gravel dirt trails, either in North America or maybe the world. I'm probably going to get fact checked on this pretty hard, but it's 2,700 miles. It kind of traverses the Continental Divide, goes from a little, you know, maybe a couple hundred miles or 100 miles inside of Mexico or inside of Canada down to Mexico. Stunning scenery. It's a race and some people will do it in like 14 days. Anyway, it's just a stunningly beautiful, long, really hard, epic ride that I did on the bucket list. So you should check it out. I think you'd dig it.
I definitely will. This looks amazing.
Yeah. Well, now that we have lost most of our non-mountain biker bikepacking people,
sorry, Justin, everyone.
No. This is great. This has been a blast. Thank you for coming on and talking. And if you're listening, again, kettleandfire.com, great bone broth, or you can check them out at your favorite grocer, A Perfect Keto. We didn't even get into Surly, which is your non-alcoholic wine, but I think that's a super cool brand that people should check out. Longjourney.vc. If you're doing something interesting, unique, that kind of has that special sauce or is in that area that Justin was mentioning, hit them up there. And then of course, TrueMed, which we got into a little bit at the beginning. If you want to be able to, are your customers there the people that want to sell products that are HSA eligible? That's who it is, right?
Yeah. So it's basically if you are selling a product that improves what we would call like a root cause health issue. So like exercise supplements, sleep aids. So like 8Sleep, Athletic Greens, CrossFit, Peloton, like all of these are our customers. If you're selling a product that makes people healthier, like we would love to hear from you as a merchant and we can talk about potentially enabling HSA and FSA for your various customers.
And then finally, justinmaris.substack.com. Highly, highly recommend the newsletter. It's exceptionally well done, entertaining, interesting, and well cited. So, Justin, anything else I missed or kind of final parting things you wanna throw out there before we wrap this up?
You crushed it. This was super fun. Thanks so much, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully, we can get out on the bikes at some point. That'd be a lot of fun.
I would absolutely love that. Yeah, that'd be epic.
That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at eCommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.